This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to a new work in Digital Humanities, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Lucas Schultz, a lecturer at the University of Manchester, and today I talk with Ross Purves. Ross is a professor of geocomputation at the University of Zurich. He has published widely in geographic information science, particularly on topics around geographic information retrieval, around the modeling and the representation of vagueness, of ambiguity and uncertainty in geographic information, but also on the modeling of environmental processes. The volume that we discuss today, Unlocking Environmental Narratives, is a volume that Ross edited together with Elgar Koblet and Benjamin Adams that is dedicated to the study of human-environment interactions through computational text analysis. And environmental narratives here are understood as written texts that focus on the environment, often describing events and experiences that took place at a particular location or in a particular type of location. And this volume introduces readers to key techniques in natural language processing, as well as seven applied case studies. So welcome to the podcast, Ross.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, it's nice to be here.
Yeah, thanks for agreeing to do this. Maybe we can open the conversation. I would like to ask you what brought you to this project?
So the book project was, as you said, so the volume was jointly edited by Olga Koblet, who at the time was doing a PhD in my group, and Ben Adams, who works in New Zealand. And the three of us all work more methodologically on text. So we work on myth, but we also have an interest in extracting information, for instance, about landscape. And one of the things that we realized was that often the questions that we were asking were maybe a bit naive, or that we needed other people to give us more insight into those questions. And University of Zurich, we have relatively generous startup funds that allow us to organize things like workshops. And what we did is we organized a workshop where we invited a group of people both with strength in methodological side of computational text analysis, but also a bunch of people who worked on different sorts of applications, different sorts of ways of thinking about text. And we had this workshop, and the idea from the start was always that the product of the workshop would be a book. How exactly that book would look at the end, we didn't really know. But what we wanted to do was to get people together. And in the case studies, that the case studies would always be driven by a question that came from a domain specialist. So, for instance, an environmental historian, someone working on policy and landscape characterization, someone working literature. So we wanted every case study to be driven by a domain specialist and to have people with methodological skills as well. And so at the workshop, we got people together and that kind of provides the center of the book, these case studies. And that's kind of where it all came from. I guess the other thing is that we wanted to write a book that would be accessible to students. So that we didn't just want to have case studies, but we wanted to have some sort of structure that told the whole story.
Yeah, that's great. So, what would you say are the key contributions of this volume?
So, I think the most important thing is that we worked really in an interdisciplinary way, and we started and ended the volume not with methods but with questions, so that we had, as I said before, we had these people from different domains who had questions that they wanted to ask about environmental narratives, and that those were kind of driving the use of the methods. So I think that idea was kind of core to what we wanted to do. I guess another thing that I think is quite important is that actually in the case studies, in some of the case studies, the methodological people, they had big ideas about what they could do. And then very often when they started working on the particular question, the corpus that they could find was, for example, much smaller than they'd hoped. And they ended up using often relatively simple methods to explore these questions. So the key to working in this interdisciplinary way wasn't really the complexity of the methods. Often it was more about really thinking about how can we at all start to get to grips with these sorts of texts. So this idea of, Joe Taylor calls it multiscalar analysis, this idea of swapping between close reading and distant reading all the time. And to do the close reading, you need someone who knows about the domain, who knows about the context of the text to work effectively. And for me, I think that's the important thing, that conversational methods on their own don't get you very far. Rather, working with a strong team of people with computational expertise and domain expertise is the thing where I think we can actually make progress.
Yeah, that stood out to me, definitely. I think that's something you emphasize throughout the book, right? The importance of domain expertise in coming up with the right questions and interpreting the findings. Could you maybe give us a rough sense of how the volume is structured, and maybe hint at maybe not all of the case studies, but at least give listeners a sense of what they are about?
Yeah, so like I said before, so it kind of has the case studies as this sort of central core. And then what we tried to do, though, was to have some introductory chapters, some introductory material that on the one hand introduced the problems and why this might be an interesting thing to work on. So why should we use text at all as a source for exploring human-environment interactions? What sort of questions there are, and then what sort of methods are available, and then at the end to kind of reflect on where we are. So one of the that we did is we have a chapter towards the beginning where we have little vignettes from different experts with different backgrounds about the sorts of questions that they ask of narratives in these different areas. So like I said, things like tourism, geography, or environmental history, literature. We have a methods chapter where we try to go through examples of quite simple things. We also try to look at issues, not just about like the nuts and bolts of the methods, but also to think a bit about some of the things that I think we often don't think about so much. So, you know, how do you build a corpus at all? What about issues to do with copyright, what about issues to do with ethics and things like that, so that we kind of can encourage students when they're working on projects on their own to reflect on these issues. And then we kind of introduce fairly simple methods, so that already get you somewhere using worked examples. The case studies, maybe I can give a few examples. So for instance, there's one that looks at glacial narratives and how they appear in different languages and in different sorts of corpora. So for instance, comparing a parliamentary corpus with a newspaper corpus. There's a case study that looks effectively at gentrification in a particular place in the US. There's case studies looking at different sorts of wildness, different ways of constructing narratives about landscape, often in Scotland, perhaps because of some of the people that were there. So one looking more at the voices that we hear and how the voices, in terms of gender, influence the way that the people write, and in another looking at ideas about historical travel writing. So there's all these different sorts of ideas coming up, and then in these case studies, there's a bunch of different methods that are used. But I think the important thing is also kind of reflecting on what the results are and actually come out. And in each of the domain experts tried to say something about, okay, what do these results mean for us? Where does this actually get us?
Yeah, that's great. Well, one thing that stood out to me, for example, in the case study on glaciers, is that when often a lot of the scholarship can be, at least the Anglophone scholarship, can be focused on strictly English language sources. In that case, the authors considered German sources as well. So it kind of struck me as interesting that there is that this is work conducted on sources in multiple languages. Could you maybe say something about that? Is that something that was important at all to the volume?
So Emily Bender says, you should always stay at the language of the corpus you're using. And I think the only thing worse than everything being in English is when people write about corpora that are in languages other than English and don't even mention it. I live in Switzerland. Switzerland is a country that is multilingual in every sense. And but we know in Switzerland that language really matters. It matters in terms of people's identity. It matters in terms of how they value, for instance, for landscape. And so I think the idea that we move away from this sort of monolinguistic idea towards starting to look at difference, starting to look at what sort of interpretations come out, is very, very important when we look at these sorts of problems. So that's definitely the case. It's a good question. I guess the group of people that came to the workshop were international. And we deliberately, for instance, Ludovic Moncloa, who came from France, has worked a lot on French text. So we deliberately invited people with methodological skills in different languages as well. So maybe that was one of the things that led to that. But I think I agree with you. I mean, for me, it's very simple. It's really important that we do this. We can't assume all these different ways of looking at the world are language independent. There's plenty of evidence that they're not.
Yeah. I mean, I think that also connects in interesting ways with current discussions, right, around multilingual digital humanities and the dominance of England of English. So that's great. That's great to see. One other thing that stands out with this volume is that it is available in open access. Could you say something about that decision to make this available in open access? And I think there's also a GitHub repo.
Yeah, so for me, from the very start, and for us as a team, it was important that what we did would be available. I mean, I think a sort of driving... So the whole idea of the sort of things we're doing is predicated on corpora being made available, upon texts being made available that we can actually analyze. And as academics, we're very demanding that these, we want things to be open. And then sometimes we're a little bit casual about actually the products that we produce, making sure that they're open as well. And we've also done, in my group, we've done something called Geograph. That's a project in the UK where volunteers take pictures and describe pictures with text, and has more than 6 million pictures of text. We've done lots of research using that corpus because it's Creative Commons. And then I think it's really imperative that anything we publish is also made available in the same way. So that was kind of important to us from the start, that the book be open access, that we try and make all the code available as reproducible as it's blockable. That's always much more challenging than we sometimes pretend. And I hope that'll lead to more people reading it. I hope it'll particularly lead to be more accessible for students, because I think it's a really nice thing if students can take a book like this and learn something useful from it and maybe get some ideas. Maybe that's one other thing that's kind of worth seeing, that the very last case study in the book by Tobias Zur is actually, which is about Frankenstein and looking at how things, how nature is representing Frankenstein. So Tobias was actually a student in a course that I teach on text and geography, and his paper, his case study, is actually basically an edited version of what he submitted as his coursework. It's also a very nice example because he was a literature student who then took a course in geographic information science. So he sort of had this interdisciplinary quality. And I think that's where I'm trying to get as well, you know, this idea that we take different aspects of our educations or people from different backgrounds and bring them together. This is pretty much always more than the parts on their own. So yeah, that's maybe a nice example of that idea. And of course, you know, if we want students to be able to look at this book, then making it really available is the best way to do it.
Yeah. I think that makes sense. And it's great that you managed to include even students in the project. So, I mean, what would you say, what advice would you give based on this to scholars who are interested in employing computational methods to explore textual, environmental narratives themselves, and who maybe have done this before?
I guess I already said it, having good questions, and having good questions probably means speaking to people from a particular domain or looking at current debates. So, you know, if we look at debates at the moment, there's a big debate about diverse and plural values of nature. And there's a lot you can read it around those debates about what that actually means and why it's important in terms of things like biodiversity and so on. And I think by sort of engaging with these debates and also by talking to scholars that are active in these areas, it opens up a different way of working. It gives us the chance of sort of answering different sorts of questions. In terms of methodologically, I think often actually taking a step back and thinking about not what's the newest, most complex method I could use to answer this question, but what's this relatively simple method that would already perhaps give me some insights is quite important. And then I think at least I'm fairly sold on this idea of this sort of multi-scalar approach, not really trying to can do these things purely computationally, but we spend a lot of time. So I guess all those things for me, and I think for Olga and Ben, were also quite important results.
Yeah. I think that is definitely one of the key takeaways, right? Like this kind of avoiding the kind of computational enthusiasm for complex and novel methods, and kind of really focusing on what can advance argument and questions based and domain expertise. So, Can I ask you, now that we've talked,
I was just going to say maybe one other thing that's worth mentioning there is I think that when we want to work in an interdisciplinary way, maybe with people who are not so familiar with computational methods, having methods that you can explain to the people you're working with is also really important. And that maybe is an additional thing that I think helps, because then you can actually have meaningful discussions about what the method means for the data if the people you're working with really understand more or less how the method actually operates.
I think that is a super important point. So now that we've talked a lot about this volume, I'm curious to know What kind of work are you doing now? What kind of project is next for you? Are you building on this work that we presented in this volume, or are you working on on new or different endeavors.
So, you is always sounds a bit you plural. Myself and some of the others in my group, and a lot of the work we are doing is concerned what ways we can extract from text information about landscape and about the ways in which landscapes are valued, or the emotions people associate with landscapes, or the senses they use to perceive landscapes. So it very much follows on from a lot of the things that we talked about in the book. I guess I'm broadly interested in answering sort of geographically relevant questions using text. And you asked about language before. I'm interested in sort of the diverse ways of representing and places. And I think text is a really powerful way of getting at that. So yeah, the work we're doing at the moment is very much a lot of it builds from this. It's looking at for example, we're working on a paper looking at discourses about rewilding in England, the Netherlands, and the UK, looking at particular species in Dutch, German, and English, and looking at how much language is controlling the discourse, how much place is controlling the discourse, and how much actually the species itself and the rewilding process in these different countries is controlling the process. So I think that follows on quite well from the source now.
Yeah. And one thing that I saw, I think, in the conclusion of the book was a mention of how it could be useful or interesting to develop new ways of visualizing this kind of evidence and working with textual evidence. Could you say a little bit more about that?
So I work in a geography department, and I teach geographic information science. I teach students how to make maps. And we talk a lot about visualization. But I think visualization, if we look at where we are in visualizing the results of these sorts of methods, you know, we often end up at things like word clouds. We're not very far along the way. And that was also kind of apparent in the book. You know, we don't have really good ways of summarizing these very large corpora. One thing is certainly thinking about more interactive approaches. But in general terms, I would say that the visualizations we have, that there's a lot of scope to do more. And I would be super interested in methods that would move us forward. I mean, again, we mentioned this multilingual thing. You know, that's a really big challenge. How do we represent data in different languages so that it's actually accessible, so people can get a sense of what's going on? So, yeah, I think there's a lot to do there. But I don't think I'm the right person to say what. I think people from the visualization community we need to get more involved on working on these sorts of problems.
Yeah, that sounds. Yeah, that sounds great. I mean, are there projects that you are, I don't know, that you have seen or that you think kind of point in the right direction in that domain that could be interesting, or is this mostly open?
I guess there's lots of work in information visualization on different ways of visualizing information and so on, but I think that in this sort of literature, where text and doing, I guess, you know, often these sort of digital humanities type things, I think often the visualizations that we're using are fairly rudimentary. I think let's put it this way: the visualizations that I use are very rudimentary, and I think, in the same way that we've kind of built this bridge fairly successfully to people with domain expertise, and we work with different people with computational methodological expertise, I do think we forget sometimes about the importance of presenting the results in useful ways. And there's a big visualization community out there that could maybe help us do that better.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds, I agree. I think there's a lot of interesting work to be done there. Well, maybe that's a good note to close this interview.
Sure.
So yeah, thanks a lot, Ross. That was really interesting. I hope that you get a large readership for this volume, and that we look forward to seeing the follow on work and the projects that you're working on that you're working on now and in the future.
Thanks a lot, Lucas.
Yeah, thanks a lot.